Testing, 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 testing.
Make sure that switch doesn't get knocked out.
Yes.
Testing, one, two, and... Now, that's why it didn't work for a second, because that had just touched that.
Yes.
That needs to be on. The battery's now powering.
This is a design fault, Charles, isn't it, having that?
Well, it is. Yeah. I mean, this clip isn't made for that microphone.
No, but it's a damn handy thing to have.
But it's a battery-powered mic, which makes it super sensitive,
yes,
rather than a dynamic one.
Yes.
And if you were dealing with elderly, frail people, it just catches everything that's there, including the budgerigar in the background.
The bird in the cage.
The
right,
bird in the cage.
That's recorded.
So you can see, always look at your little meter there, that's moving. If that's not moving, you're in trouble.
Right.
Don't bother carrying on because something's wrong. The little light is showing you that a signal is coming in. So we press stop. Five, six, testing. Four, five, six. That looks like it's working now.
Right.
Now you need to stop it and go back just to see if it is working. Now.
Saturday the 15th of April, and I'm recording on behalf of the Manx Heritage Foundation, and it's my great pleasure to welcome to the museum this afternoon Mr. Dursley Stott, stockbroker and son of the late Robert Stott, who founded the stockbroking firm of R.L. Stott & Company, to record his recollections of that important sector and the development of the island's finance industry over the last 40 years. Dursley, welcome to the museum.
Thank you.
When exactly did your father found the company?
Father took over the company in 1936. From Mr. Arthur Milligan Jackson, whose previous father, I believe, started Jackson & Co., or it would just be the initials and Jackson in those days. And he was originally, which I've looked up in the museum, in 23 Attle Street. His son, Arthur Milligan Jackson, moved to 20 Attle Street, and he died, as I say, in 36, sometime in 36. Father, who had decided to become a stockbroker, was being trained by Horse Fell and Brothers in Liverpool, now no longer, and used to go over on the boat every Monday and back every Friday. And when Mr. Jackson died, his father came back, I assume, on the Friday, went to see his widow, I believe in Ramsey for some reason, and bought the business and opened on the Monday as successor to A.M. Jackson. It's interesting in those days, because I've looked again up the records, that father's, when he took over from Jackson, Jackson was a travel agent, an insurance agent, a shipping agent, presumably got commissioned for all of these things.
Yes.
And father went down Attle Street and sort of gave him away to various people who were in that business. He said he didn't want to do that, he wanted to be in stockbroking and nothing else.
So
and that was 1936.
1936, concentrating purely on
stockbroking, yes. Yeah.
And what sort of client base would have he had in those days?
Well, looking through the records, which I will give you if I can find them again, it was mostly, it was quite a lot of local shares were bought. And in those days, of course, the pound was worth a pound, a guinea was worth a guinea, and there were a lot of fixed interest stocks. In fact, looking somewhere, I don't know where they are now, my grandfather's records, my grandfather to have bought something like ICI, if there had been such a thing, then it would have been considered speculation.
Yes.
And in those days, in fact, even when I started in 59, gilts, government stocks, yielded less than equities. And I lived through the period of the cult of the equity. massive inflation, but that's another story. But so, to go back to your question, they bought a lot of local shares. There were also government stocks an issue those days. Nearly all the commissioners here had stocks, corporation stocks an issue. They had even when I started. And they bought, it moved on to buying overseas stocks, but I don't know what else they bought in those days. It would be a bit of overseas stuff, stuff that I don't suppose tax was terribly important then either, you know, not like today.
One of the things that we think of today in terms of stock brokering and share prices is the rapid transfer of information on share prices. In those days, it must have been extremely delayed or difficult to get the prices. Is that right?
Well, talking Father's Day, but before we get to my day, he did tell me once that for an order over £100, they would send a telegram. Because again, £100 equivalent today would have been 1,000 now.
Yes.
But anything under, they wrote a letter.
Yes.
I mean, they just wrote a letter, you know, to the agents in Liverpool or London, which is, to our day, a way of thinking of young people in the year 2000, yes, is quite remarkable. And that, of course, that dissemination of information, don't need me to tell you, has been the biggest step forward that I have seen, the biggest alteration of our methods and everything. And even when I started in, which perhaps a bit early to go on to it, in 59, we used to get from our London agents in the morning the opening prices. Of course, in those days, the market opened at 9:30 for equities and 10 for gilts, much more civilized than today.
Yes.
And they used to ring through with our set list of share prices and gilts. And we used to have this typed, and it would go on our board in the entrance hall or reception room. And then we would send it to what were in those days our institutions, which were basically banks and maybe an insurance company.
Yes.
And then at about 12 o'clock, we get another set of prices. And about before they closed in the afternoon. And if anybody wanted to deal, we would say, well, the last price we had of ICI was 54 shillings or something.
Yes.
And they'd say, oh, well, if they're about that sort of price, we'll deal. Now, if you got a man that said, well, I wanted an exact price, we would then have to ring up London or whatever, I'll explain the dealing later, and get the price, you see. And then, because you go on the phone to him, he said, oh, well, look, if they're 54 and sixpence, buy them. Of course, by the time you went back to London, they could have been 55 shillings. You then had to go back to him. So it became, you know, a very... And just as an aside, the phones in those days, in my day when I started,
yes,
were very big, black, heavy instruments.
Yes.
And I think my father and both Sid Ashworth, his colleague, both went deaf through shouting into these huge phones and been on them all day. I think that helped them go deaf, maybe in old age, but I think it helped.
It probably developed your arm muscles.
Yes, well, nothing else.
Lifting
yes.
them up.
Yeah.
When you left university, and I bear in mind that we will be talking in future sessions about your time at Cambridge and in the army, when you left university and you came back to the island, was it always your intention and your father's intention that you would join the family firm?
Well, you've got to split that because at the age of seven, I wanted to be a stockbroker. At the age of seven...
Very early decision.
Yeah, my brother wanted to go into property. At the age of seven, my son wanted to be a racing driver. Now, I probably was brainwashed by my father, but in actual fact, he always made a point of saying, you must never come into my business because you think you have to. And I believe he really meant that. I think he would have been disappointed if I hadn't, but he really meant that I must only come if I wanted to. And then I wanted to know what a good stockbroker was. I still do. But it was a very, it's something that always fascinated me. And I must say, if I had my time over again, with the benefit of the experience that you have got now, I'd have gone into merchant banking, which would have been more my street, really. But in those days, you know, merchant banking was almost a sort of, you know, like going to the House of Lords. You know what I mean? It was a sort of family, the Kaisers and the Rothschilds, you know, and all these sort of people. So I'd always wanted, actually, to, come back to Isle of Man and to enlarge that a free time. I used to go in the office in holidays, in a vacation, just to have a look around, help a bit and sort of learn a bit. And then when I went in, Father made me, he started me by doing the post, and then the filing for months. And then I had to go into every single department. And he said, the only reason you've got to do this is because, he said, if you become the boss one day, he said, if the staff know you can do the job, you're all right. If they think you can't, he said, you're going to have problems. So he said, you will learn everything in this office. He said, by the way, if you have to hire people, you also have to fire them. You never ask anybody else to do it. It's very good, isn't that?
Yes.
So then he said to me after a year, he said, right, you better go to London and just go into statistical departments and the dealing, you know, on the floor. He said, don't go messing about doing dividends. He said, a waste of time. So father sent me up to London, and my wife and I were married then, and we had a little baby, and our kitchen was a cupboard in the wall in a tiny little flat. That was the kitchen. I mean, it was amazing.
Whereabouts in London was that?
It was not far away, thank God. It was 6 tube stops, because I hate the tube. Where the hell was it? Buckingham Palace Gate. That's right. And the joke about it was, I always remember getting on the tube the first time and got out, you see, and then walked from Monument, I think, up to the thing. And on the way back that evening, as people got in, I moved up the tube. But I didn't realise in London nobody seems to know what the words excuse me mean. I missed the tube getting out. So anyway, I always wanted to come back to the Isle of Man. And the point of this story is that I was walking down, I think it must have been London Wall, with my senior partner. And I was very I was a trainee, really, you see. And it doesn't matter when this goes out, but a chap went past called Nicky Mountain, whose father was Sir Brian Mountain, who was chairman of Eagle Star. And I happened to have read Scottish Law for a little while with Nicky Mountain. And he said, oh, hello, Dad. Say hi. And he said, I said, fine. I said, have you met Daddy? He said, I said, no, I haven't. He said, this is my father, you know. I said, how do you do, sir? I said, may I introduce my senior partner? And yes. So my senior partner was terribly impressed, you see, that I knew these people. And he said to me, you know, a very big business. He said, could you take me? And I said, of course, you see. So when I was due to leave that firm, he said to me, look, I've spoken to my partners. And he said, we'd like you to be a junior partner, you see. I said, it's very kind of you, sir. He said, we're going to pay you £5,000 a year, which, you know, that was my ambition at the time, was to make £100,000, to invest it at 5%, to have £5,000. I mean, it was a fortune to me.
A lot of money.
What? And he said, you know, we'll put you up for the stock exchange. Because very much Club London was easier to get into than the other market. And he said, you know, well, I propose you my second partner. He said, you'll be in, you know. He said, what about it? Well, I said, it's very, very kind of you, sir, and I do appreciate it, and I'm very flattered that you think I'm worthy of it, but I've always wanted to go back to the Isle of Man. And I had, actually.
Yes.
So I came back, and father paid me £250 a year.
There is a slight difference.
Yes. When I got married, he said, I think I better make 500, you know. So, and that's true. Yeah.
Well, that's an amazing story, but of course it gave you exposure to the centre of stock dealing and equities at the London market.
Oh, it was a very useful experience, because, I mean, I knew all the firms that we dealt with, and I've always believed all my life, and still do, even now when I'm still doing it, in this sort of old age. In fact, I went up to London last week to meet some people that I speak to on the phone, because I like to know the people I'm speaking to.
Yes.
It's a very old-fashioned thing, but I think you get a better service from them, and you give them, and they know you. And it's just an old... I just like the personal contact, which all my business life has been. These days it's becoming very, very impersonal. But I don't mean me, I mean the way the systems are. And I do believe in that, and I always have believed in it. And I still think it's terribly important, actually, myself.
I've had the pleasure of... and have the pleasure of looking through the family archives.
Mm.
One of the things that I remember seeing was a very... proud little letter from your father to his business associate saying it's his great pleasure to welcome to his firm you.
Yeah.
And it must have been a source of great pride to him to have, have you on board.
Yeah, now you see, to carry that on to my son said from a very early age he wanted to be a racing driver, but from a very early age he said, look, Dad, he said, I want you to know, he said, I'm not the sort who can sit in an office. And he's not. He's just not one of those people. When my daughter was always reading, and Paul was always about kicking a football.
Yes.
But the kid's fair enough. But he just did, he feels cloistered, maybe claustrophobic. I don't know, but he said, so I want you to know that. Well, actually, it was really, in a way, quite a relief, because at least I knew I didn't have to keep it going if I had to keep it going for him.
Yes.
Well, I would have done.
Yes.
And when, in the early 80s, the Stock Exchange said you could sell 10% of your business.
Yes.
And it was fairly obvious to me that it was going to change anyway. And I didn't think that our business would survive the same way that we had. The reason for that is we had fixed rate commissions, as you probably know. And a lot of London firms, by that I mean the institutions, sort of unit trusts and funds, used to give me an order every so often.
Yes.
Well, if you got an order to buy £500,000 worth of Shell, for example, at full rates of commission, it made up for an awful lot. I don't mean this in an unnatural or unkind way, but it made up for a lot of smaller transactions.
Yes, of course.
But I couldn't see that when we weren't allowed dual capacity, because we were allowed to deal in local shares as jobbers.
Yes.
That's another story. And also brokers with a private client. Once you had negotiated commissions and all the other things were going to happen, I felt the time was coming, and I decided to sell, and I had 13 offers, serious offers, seven very serious, and one delightful offer, so I sold. But I went to my father first.
Yes.
And said, you know Paul doesn't want to go. And he said, yes, I do. And I said, he said, you'll never get a price like this again. So he said, if you want to sell it, your business, you sell it. But I wanted him to, if he'd have said no, I wouldn't have sold it.
You're reliant on his advice implicitly.
Yeah, I did in that case. Yes. I mean, I didn't have to, but yes. I felt out of courtesy and the fact that he'd built it up.
Indeed.
And although my wife says I built it up a bit further, which is very kind of her, I still felt I should have asked him, which I did. And he said, and of course I got a very good price. And on that score, there's a bit of name dropping. I rang a friend of mine called Sir Michael Richardson, who was, he was Rothschilds and Smith Newcourt. Smith Newcourt was a subsidiary of, is now a subsidiary of, well, it's now become Merrill Lynch, actually, to be honest. And I said, oh, Michael, Leon has suggested that I ring you for some advice. He asked, what do you want? I said, how many times a year should I sell my business for you? He said, okay, he said, if you can get 6 times earnings, you'll be doing terribly well. You know. So he said, and by the way, I'm not charging you for this advice. I said, I should think not. I sold at 11 times earnings, so it was, and he said, would you like to come and work for me and sell a few things up here? So, and perhaps do I look back and regret it? And I don't think I ever have regretted it, really. I'm not a person who regrets things after, so I regret mistakes, but I'm not sorry that I sold it, because it is, the world has changed so much, and we'll go into that at a later time.
Yes.
Us getting staff here today and all the complications. It's a different world, anyway, never mind.
One thing I find absolutely amazing is the fact you say that at 7 you had decided to become a stockbroker.
Yeah, we all did, all the family.
Amazing.
Yeah, well, I don't know why we did, really, but we all had this early ambition, I think, all of us. And incidentally, just for the record, my brother's story is an interesting one, just for a second, because...
This is Brian.
Yes, he always wanted to go into property, Brian. Yes. I mean, from a very small age. Actually, my son's very good at it, too, but Paul, Brian always wanted to go in. And his godfather was a chap called Harry Johnson,
yes.
Which became Johnson and Shimon.
Yes, of course. Yes.
And Harry was a pal of my father's, and they were on the Sefton board together. I don't think Harry was on the Palace board. But in those days, it was often very wrongly, possibly, but the same people on different boards, sort of all the same people,
yes.
Slight differences.
Yes.
And when my brother wanted to go into property, Harry Johnson said, well, if he goes away, gets his qualifications at university, he went to London University, I'll take him in when he comes back. And when Brian did all of this, of course, and came back, and then Harry said he had no room for anybody, he said it wasn't big enough, which was a bit of a shock and a great disappointment. So Brian then shifted himself up to Turner's, the Crystals.
Yes, Crystals, yes.
Turner Crystal and his brother Fred, and said that he'd like to join them, and they said they would take him. And he rang me and told me, I said, well, you're very fortunate, that's a very long established. He said, I've told him. He said, if they don't change the name to Crystal Brothers and Stoddard, I'm not going. I said, Brian, that's a hell of a nerve, because, Crystals are nearly 100 years old then, Anyway, they did. And he opened their Douglas office.
Yes.
And, of course, moved out. He retired from that much earlier directly. He's still in property to this day, but in a different way.
And, of course, the two of you have become leading members of the business community within the island. And indeed further afield. Before we leave stockbroking, and we'll return to this in later discussion, I would like to ask you what I think is a very important question. What is the future of stockbroking?
Well, what I think of the future?
Yes.
Well, if you take... I was brought up to believe that a stockbroker had 3 functions. One was to buy and sell the shares to the best of his ability for a client at any given moment. Secondly was to give advice. And thirdly was to raise funds for new companies, that went on the stock exchange.
Indeed.
Now, in many ways, all 3 functions have to some degree been usurped. It doesn't mean to say stockbrokers still don't do them. But if you take the first one of dealing, now... I'm afraid I may have to go on a few minutes here, but in our day, of course, there were jobbers, now called market makers, and there may be 10 jobbers in one stock. Am I right? So you would go to the market maker in ICI and say, quote ICI, please, and he'd give you a price. And you go to, so you did the best bid was, say, whatever, and the cheapest offer, and you deal with either, depending which way you were. Now, that's all gone. You can still deal with the market makers on the phone today, but because of what they call set stock exchange electronic trading, on your screens, which we didn't have, we used to have a floor and go on and speak to people. That's why I always found it important to know the person, because they'd help you at times, you could help them.
Yes, indeed.
Now you just look at your screen, and the yellow strip on the top tells you the cheapest offer and the best selling price, and you deal. Now the young people today deal straight on that. I mean, they deal in, this is an exaggeration, but the speed of light compared to the way we dealt. Mm. So that has been the biggest change. Now, it is almost electronic. And just to take the future of stockbroking on that side alone, I believe the future of stockbroking, this is just me, and I have told the firms I've been with recently, and they may or may not believe me, that I think every stockbroking firm, whatever it's a part of or whatever, should have a separate subsidiary or part of their business which just does straight execution business. That's where you give no advice. In fact, under the regulations, we're not allowed to give advice to an execution client. It wants to just, now that should be done as cheap as possible, 15 quid a bargain, 20 quid a bargain, five, whatever. That's very cutthroat. It needs volume. Volume has increased in Britain because of the privatization and other reasons, but we're nowhere near as capitalistic as the Americans. Nowhere have we any number of the population of what 250, 300 million, we've got what 70 million. But the Brits are sort of picking up a bit. If volume goes down, as my father used to say, if the market conditions are wrong in the market, you won't do anything anyway. You're very governed by market conditions. Yeah. Like this last week, where you've seen the high Texan belt.
Dramatic yesterday.
Yeah, and yes, but I mean, we've seen most of it before. But
yes.
Anyway, so I do believe that execution dealing and dealing, as we've known it, is changing. You have real-time prices now, rather than the phone call, which can change. You can deal, ba-donk, and you can deal on a button. You don't need to speak to anybody. I mean, I've watched the kids in the office I'm in at the moment. They've done. We were given 120 deals one afternoon at 20 past four, UK equity market. It closes at 4:30. In the old days, Roger, if I'd have had 20 dealers, I couldn't have done it. And no way could I do it. No way could you have rung up and got the best price. They did that at just after, well, I shouldn't say, because not, but just after half past four.
Yes.
They literally did. No way could you do that today.
No.
So that is the future. And I've always said, and this isn't conceited, I've said for years now, you can ask anybody, I believe that the time, even I may live to see it, where you'll have a thing like a watch on your hand. Mm. And I believe it'll be a phone. I believe I'll depressing it all the indices. I believe I'd even be able to put on the share prices that I want. I do believe that will happen.
Yeah.
My difficulty would be seeing it with my eyesight now, but I mean, that will actually, so that to deal with that, I think that's a complete change. As far as advice is concerned, all sorts of people give advice today, although you have to be qualified to do so, and you have to be registered to take orders, you have to be qualified to give advice correctly, it may be bad advice, but at least you qualify. Mm. And that's, so again, it's not just purely a stockbroker's function. And thirdly, raising money is anything but a stockbroker's function now. I mean, there's advisors, there's merchant banks, there's lawyers, there's accountants, and the stockbroker comes in at the end to place the stock in whichever way it's done, whichever form of issue it is. So I believe the future then, to go back to the question, was that it'll be execution dealing as a separate entity of a big firm, or, as in fairness, Tilneys have just done here, I believe, given away their execution clients. They don't want them. And the other, discretionary advice, will be fee charging.
Yes.
Because then you get fees, whatever the market.
Yes.
Done like accountants and lawyers. And I do believe, myself,
yes,
that should be here already, although it isn't quite, but it's well on its way. And that's, to me, is the future of stockbroking. That's my view, anyway.
And portfolio management would be...
Well, that would come under discretionary advice or advisory.
Yes.
And there'd be different charges.
Yes.
The reason the different charges... I mean, yesterday, for example, perhaps I shouldn't say this, but perhaps in 20 years' time it might look right, I bought Lloyds Bank for people because I reckoned at £6 something, they've come down from £11. That doesn't mean to say they're cheap necessarily. I personally think they are cheap. They are a core growth holding. They're one of the best banks, in my opinion. I'm talking stock exchange in Britain.
Yes.
And I bought them yesterday. Now, for my discretionary clients, where I'm trying to achieve a certain amount of capital gain, it's all laid down what they're trying to achieve and what I'm trying to achieve with them.
Yes.
It's all written out these days and signed and everything. I reckon they're a very good buy. So I can go on and buy 1,000, 10,000, 100,000 shares and allocate them. But my advisory clients, you see, I have to ring them up. Well, as it happened, the shares dropped during the day anyway, so they were less at the end of the day in the beginning. But you know, I mean, by the time I've rung every advisory client, you could be paying 10p more, 20p more, 30p more. You might have lost it. So it depends on the client who may not trust you or want to be advised before you do anything, which is fair enough. So there'll be different sorts of fees. You see, discretionary you can do so much quicker. You can charge less because it's easier in a different sense.
Yes.
Whereas advisory, you've got to ring them more, write to them, trustees, whatever. So you see, I can see different scales, obviously, for that. I also believe that charities in future, and I have offered this to somebody over here, that I said to them, look, what I'll do is I won't charge you any commission at all, which gave them quite a surprise, but I'll charge you a flat fee of so much a quarter, whatever. and said, you pay in advance.
Yes.
Plus VAT. And how about that? And I think they were quite shattered. But they said, well, why not charge any commission? I said, because I'm going to charge a fee instead.
Yes.
But I said, over £1 million. If you do a deal over £1 million, then I may charge you something.
Yes.
You know, at an agreed scale.
Yes.
Now, that, I think, is an approach, too, that is already coming. Because if you know, lots of fees are going down. Because I, in spite of the talk yesterday of inflation, because of American rates going to go high, one of the interesting things about stock exchange, if something's expected, it's a damp squib, it's an anticlimax. If something happens that isn't expected, then they get very twitchy. And yesterday, you see, we've all been expecting interest rates, and I still expect interest rates to go up in America, the US, UK, and Europe. But you see, they came out and said instead of 25 basis points, it would be 50. So the markets. So we're now talking about inflation. But I believe that there may be some inflation, always has been since the time of the Egyptians. But I think we're in a period of deflation, which I have never seen.
A most extraordinary economic state of affairs. I think in the 1920s there were periods of deflation,
right.
which followed, of course, the stock exchange crash.
That's right, in 1929.
And the Great Depression.
Mm.
But of course, the world economy today is how can I put it? Is so reliant on each other.
That's right.
That when America sneezes, as the old saying goes, that
we get pneumonia,
catches a cold, or whatever.
Yeah, we still get pneumonia. Look at yesterday.
Indeed.
But I think because it is a global economy, it's very different to what it used to be. People are more concerned now about the overall effect rather than the isolation of, well, to hell with England, America's all right, or vice versa.
Yes.
That's all changed. I mean, it's completely changed.
Darcy, I'm very interested to pick up on a point here which you mentioned about the dealing side only being a separate function within the business as a must development. The advent of internet share dealing, I'm obviously reading in the newspapers about this sort of thing, and it's a very impersonal way of doing business. And I guess from what you're saying already that you like the personal touch. This is the tradition of
your business. That's going there. Yeah,
but that is to be regretted.
It is, but it's there isn't time for it.
Yes.
That's what it basically comes to, this hurried world. We've no time to stand on the stairs. I said, we've no time to do anything but get on with it. And I'm afraid that has gone. It won't go, you see. Depending if you're a private stockbroker for private clients or institutional, even institutional, you'll go and visit your people or you visit the companies. You don't deal directly very much with individuals in private clients. Your private clients you still speak to and have to have dialogue and intercourse because every client is slightly different. And what you may take is high risk, this fellow may say, that's no problem to me at all, but I'll take an even higher risk. Or I don't want that sort of risk. You know. So there will still be that side of it, but the dealing is going to become purely automatic in split seconds. So to go back to the internet trader, most of them go bust, by the way, after about 3 months, that will happen and is happening and will continue to happen. But I do believe a lot of those people, and I have no fact for saying there's no backing, but I don't think they know what the shares do, nor do I think they're interested in what the shares do. They don't care whether they make coal, coffee, tea, or whatever. They just buy shares if they're going up.
Yes.
I mean, at the turn of flock, they hope.
Yes.
But you see, you wouldn't have been able to get out in a panic market like we've had this last few days. That's when people get burned. You can't get out unless it's a big share.
I want to return to this fascinating world of stockbroking.
Yeah.
And I'm very interested in this, and I think it's something that we must talk about in greater detail at a future date. But what I'd like to turn now, Dursley, to your return to the Isle of Man at a time of an emerging financial sector where today most people credit the late Sir John Bolton with laying the foundations for development of the industry, which today has such a dominant role in the Manx economy. As a MHK and an MLC, Sir John wore many hats during his 40 years in politics, chairman of the Finance Board 66 to 77, member of the Executive Council for 23 years, chairman of Income Tax Commission, member of the Common Market and Common Purse Agreement Committee, and Standing Committee on Common Interests of the Isle of Man and the UK. What are your recollections of him?
Well, before we get to him, the financial sector hadn't emerged in 1959.
Right.
And as I said, I went to London in 60 for most of the year. Not all, but a good part of it. And when I came back, the people, as I said earlier, dealt in sort of a few local shares, a few fixed interest stocks. They started dealing a few South African securities because of tax reasons and American, Canadian particularly, but that's we'll go into that. But I said to my father, if things don't buck up here, I think I'll have to go back to London, Dad, because I don't think there is enough business for the firm, you know what I mean, to sort of keep an extra, because he made me a partner in 62.
Yes.
Now, I used to meet with, you see, I hadn't got a strict contemporary and out of man from school until about 1962, because none of them had any work here. I mean, the one or two older is doing a chartered accountancy and lawyers, you know, like all my in-laws now, and cousins are all lawyers, advocacy. But do you know what I mean? There was no emerging thing now. 1961, 62, I think England started to return, I suppose to give away, it depends which way you look at it, return the colonies to the indigenous people. And that brought a swathe of people, particularly from Africa, East and West Africa, to the Isle of Man.
Were they encouraged to come here?
I don't know. I've always been, perhaps wrongly, credited in London, certainly in the late 60s and early 70s, the fact that people over here have come here to retire, who said that I was the only person that was going to London selling the Isle of Man. I don't mean that in any big-headed way. They said you were the only person we'd ever heard of. We all thought it was down the south coast till you came to London and started telling us it wasn't. But to go back to what happened, now, somewhere around that time, and you'd have to get the dates, 61, 62, 63, we had surtax in the Isle of Man. And now, I understand this may have to be apocryphal, but you had to earn £2,000 a year before you paid surtax. And I've been told, and this may be a total story, that only 83 people paid it in the Isle of Man. And quite frankly, I believe that. Now, when we did away with surtax, then the income tax receipts, we were paying 25 and I think 5 shillings in those days. And it started to increase, as it always does, because there's no point in defrauding or cheating or trying to evade, as opposed to avoid tax. Avoiding is still legal, in my opinion. Evasion isn't. So that was an encouragement. And I do know, because some of them are still alive to this day, my clients who came from East Africa. In fact, one gentleman is 85 now.
Yes.
I mean, and from West Africa. And what amazed me, they had the wrong portfolios. You know, considering they were in a sort of offshore, diverted commerce situation, they didn't have the tax-exempt guilt, some of them. Anyway, I'm not blaming anybody. It's just that it was a different world. A lot of East Africans, East African breweries and all sorts of things.
Yes.
So we had a change of portfolios.
Yes.
So, and not for the sake of commission. I mean, it's just to sort of adjust the tax positions
yes,
for
indeed.
Them. Perhaps we paid too much attention to tax. But anyway, so that brought in a lot of business, and the business started to increase, you see. Now, during that time, I was told that, and I've been told this by Clifford Irving, who's still alive to this day,
indeed, yes.
That he told me that he suggested to the then John Bolton that they did away with surtax.
Clifford Irving?
Yeah.
Yes.
That's what he told me.
Right.
And I believe him
to
a certain degree. But it was John Bolton who forced it through. But I think at that time, I may be right here, that Sir Ronald Garvey was the Lieutenant Governor who wrote and asked for a job when he left Fiji or wherever the hell he left. You know that, do you?
No, I didn't.
Yes, he did, yeah.
Really?
Yes, he wrote to Home Office and said he's retiring from wherever that he was retiring from, and there were any jobs going. That's the story. It's in his book, anyway. Now, he was the man who also led it. So you had a combination there, which was most unusual. You had who became Sir John Bolton. And incidentally, when he got his OB, I rang up the governor and said he should have got a knighthood. He got one the next year,
yes.
So I think it was a bit like. But he, with the backing of somebody like Clifford, Clifford was a good politician. He was a bit of a statesman, Clifford, you know. And who's ever going to hear all of this?
This is going to be a long time in the future.
Somebody said he sat on the fence so much he thought it would hurt him for a while. But anyway, I'm very fond of Clifford Irving. But he actually ended away with the Usury Act as well. But he actually, I can't remember who was the third member of the Finance Board at the time, but they definitely were the inspiration. Brought about by a chain of events of the countries being given back, the colonies, people coming, lowering tax, driven by Garvey, who sort of led us in the UK. Because don't forget, we're very different to the UK, still are, far too good, in my opinion. But you know what I mean? They were all sort of nervous of the UK, as they still are. I don't follow it all, but they are. That's another sort of Manx sort of thing. So it was a combination, and the spearhead was Garvey and Bolton. I have no doubt about it. And the fact that the colonies became no longer colonies.
Well, you mentioned the abolition of surtaxes.
Mm.
And again, it's credited to Sir John Bowles.
No, it's probably rightly so. I mean, he would drive it, but I'm certain that, I know it's always been credited to him, but I think you want to get a hold of Clifford Irving whilst he's still around.
I'd like to go and
get that, and I'd do it soon, because he's not a well man. You know, he's got asthma badly and so on.
Yes, I must go and see him.
And get that sorted out, you know, because everybody, I'm not trying to discredit Bolton, quite the contrary. In fact, I'll tell you two diverse stories there. They asked me, which is very flattering when I was a very young man, what I would do if I was in their position. I said, well, what's your problem? And they were lending long and borrowing short, which apart from women, the horses and drink is the best way to go bankrupt there is. And they said, what would you do? You see, and I said, well, if I were you, gentlemen, I'd probably call them sir. You see, I used to be polite to them. I said, I would employ a merchant bank, you see. And they said, what's a merchant bank? I said, that's a very good question. But I said, there are top ones in London. And I said, you should go to them. And don't go with your cap in your hand. You are a country, you are a government, and say you want something to advise the government on financial matters and how much you charge on. Well, who would you? I said, look, you must choose your own. I said, there's plenty of them, but I said, there's Warburgs, there's Rothschilds, and of course they chose Warburgs. They said, well, why should we do this? So I said, well, I said, if I was a politician and they were successful, I said, I'd take the credit. Now, I said, if things go wrong, you blame them. And they all, I could see the three of them. I could see the light. They all said, oh, yes. So, anyway, off the street.
I think that's some very good advice.
Anyway, they went off and appointed Warburgs. And to finish the story, one day my wife and I, Mark and I, were going to London, and somebody very kindly sent a roller for us, which was exceptionally unusual. And JB and Mary were sort of, that's me, JB and Mary were sort of going, sorry, can you put that off? Would you and Mary, I probably called her Mrs. Bolton, like a lift into London, you see? He said, oh, yes, he said to us. He said, oh, yes, he said, that would be very nice, he said. So I said, well, you sit in the front. I don't know if you said John or not then, probably not. And Mrs. Bolton and I sit in the back. He said, we're sitting in the back. We're going along the M4, whatever, with the old one in those days, when you pass a Goodyear business, you know, not the M4, the A4 or whatever. And he said, you know, he said to us, he said, Warburg sold our war loan yesterday, you see. So I thought, all right. So I didn't say anything. When I came back down, I rang him up. He said, I said, JB, can I have a word? He said, yeah. I said, you said in the car that J. Warburg sold a war. And he said, yes. I said, who did they do it through? Oh, London, he said. So I said, well, why didn't they do it through Crook Halls or us? Oh, no, don't say they have to do it to London. I said, no, they don't, JB. I think that's quite wrong. I said, we are capable of selling something like that, either of us. But I said, if we make a cock of it, then you should knock us out. Oh, well, I don't think so. I said, well, if we are not given the opportunity. I said, this is not a threat, it's a promise. I said, you're up for re-election soon, aren't you? He said, yeah. I said, I'm going to come to every one of your meetings, and I'm going to stand up and say, Mr. Bolton, you're chairman of the finance board, or wherever you are, you give all this business to London, the commission must be hundreds of thousands, and we're getting nothing on it. You're not even getting any tax from it. And I said, I think that's very wrong. You wouldn't do that. I said, I would, and I will. So he rang up Treasury Bill Dawson, or Treasury Bill rang me, as he was called. Wonderful name, Treasury Bill. And he said, Dursley, I think we'd better have a chat here, and you and I had better go up and see Warburgs, you see. I said, that's the idea. So next thing he rang, he said, well, Dursley, we needn't go. Warburgs are coming over. Now, to finish this remarkable, it is quite unusual. This is a remarkable story.
Yes, it is.
So Warburgs came over, you see, a couple of snooty-nosed young twits, you know, from the city, graduates and so on. And they said, I understand that you know, well, I think what we can do, we prefer to deal through London, of course, you know. So I said, well, that's understandable, you're all London people. But he said, who do you use for gilts? So I said, we'll use Munster. Government brokers. Well, I tell you what, Stott, we'll put it through them, and they'll put it through you, and you can share the commission. So it was just agreement how much commission I got a year, you see, for the firm. And now we got, I think, from memory, a couple of thousand, which was a very useful sum in those days. So I said, well, that's right. He said, by the way, he said, do you have any chance of, I can't remember which stock, but I can tell you which summer, 75,000 Braddon 4% commissioners, 40,000 Lexies 8 commissioners. And, so, and do you know, I don't know whether the good Lord said, I'll help this lad. Do you know, I had a buyer for each of those three corporation and Braddon commissioners was one, I'll always remember. In the amounts they had to sell.
Incredible.
Now, that was a chance in I don't know how many million. And I'm not taking them on the book. I actually had buyers. So I said, what sort of prices do you want for these? So I said, well, I think that's a little on dear side. I'll give you whatever it was, you know. And I'll offer you for that. And I'll take you. He said, are you, there's a lot of money now. He said, are you actually offering to buy them? I said, if I've just said I'll buy them, I'll buy them. And I said, just you tell me what price. So he said, well, look, we've been trying to get rid of these for a long time. I said, well, you see, you haven't been using local brokers, you see. By chance, I said, he said, Mary, what?
My goodness. So,
but that was lucky. That was just sheer luck.
It is rather incredible.
But it was luck.
Yes.
But we had a buyer for each of those stocks.
Yes.
And that actually was in itself remarkable. So, of course, we then got some business.
Dursley, I'm conscious of...
Sorry, it's me talking too much.
No, it's wonderful stuff, and this is only the start of many of our talks, but I'm conscious that you have to go off to meet yourself. I'd like to finish by just reading you something that Sir John Bolton said in 1979.
No longer down then, yeah.
Nearing his retirement. And he spoke of Tynwald as he had found it in 1946, and he said there was no health service. There was no social security, no executive council. The government secretary was also the government treasurer, and the governor was the government. It was reckoned that the House of Keys was the official opposition in 1946.
Yeah, yeah.
Things have come on a long way.
Yeah.
And when we meet again shortly, we talk further about those days of the development of the finance sector.
Amazing, amazing development. Yeah.
Dursley, thanks for a fascinating
conversation. Thank you. Well, I can chatter for hours. You know. If you put that off now...